please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Tucker. I'm here today on behalf of Dunn & Black, a law firm over in Spokane. And I'm here on their behalf to ask this court to defend the contingency fee system in place and also to uphold the principle that one who creates a common fund is entitled to be compensated for its efforts. This case is about
a problem is you got a lot of statutory law against you on that. First of all, what about jurisdiction? What was the jurisdiction of the court here?
I think that the jurisdiction was proper pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1346. The court found that was proper. This is a federal question involving the status of liens, priority, and that gets to the heart of the applicability of 26 U.S.C. 6323.
All right. Let's stay on 1346 for a moment. What does the record show about your exhaustion of that claim with the IRS?
Exhaustion of the claim?
Under 7422, you can't bring a 1346 claim unless you exhaust.
I don't know what the record indicates as far as the exhaustion of remedies goes. I know that it was proper to pursue our remedy in the district court in Eastern Washington.
I'm sorry? Did the government raise in the district court the jurisdictional question generally?
It did.
Did it raise the exhaustion question specifically?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
It raised it. So it does raise it briefly in its brief and appeal, but not before this?
That wouldn't be proper then before this court.
I'm sorry?
That wouldn't be proper before
so
this court.
So you believe that the exhaustion issue as such was not raised in the district court?
No, I don't believe it was.
But you still rely on 1346 as the basis for jurisdiction and sufficient to waive sovereign immunity by the government so you can bring the claim.
Correct. I believe the district court is correct in holding that and permitting this claim to go forward. This case is about a client, Environmental Reclamation Incorporated, and their dealings with Federal Highway Administration on a complex road construction project in Idaho in a town called Warren, or outside of Warren, which is about 200 miles south of Rathdrum. And this client would not have been able to pursue its claim against the Federal Highway Administration for its wrongful termination had it not been for the contingency fee system.
I think you should begin from the premise that you have many equities. The question is, do you have statutory authority behind your contentions? In other words, the equities are fine, but we're dealing with the government and with many, as Judge O'Scanlan says, statutory limitations on the ability to recover against the government. So I'm just suggesting you're not going to get very far.
Well,
we're just arguing the equities.
Right,
you have equities, many of them. The district court recognized it as well. The question is, why do you win?
I think the court's reference to 6323, the super priority statute, I think is the issue I want to address first, because I think it completely sets where the district court went wrong in its decision. The super priority doesn't even come into play here. In the Treasury regulation referred to by this court, 301.6323 subsection B, 1H3, example 3, just referred to as example 3, shows a misplaced reliance on 6323. Because the super priority statute, it's created to help those who are not first in time, to jump up above those who are and able to recover. And in this case, Dunn & Black had the first lien. It was first in time under Idaho statute, which controls here. It was first in time as of January 3rd, 2002.
I gather that's disputed also, right? Because the contention, as I understand it, is that until there was a judgment, you don't have a sufficiently co-ate lien for federal government purposes.
The way I understand the argument against that is that there couldn't have been an enforceable lien because the judgment sum was not concrete.
Right.
Which means that it was inchoate, at least to that extent.
But that gets to the point about the contingency fee system as a whole. If no sum is going to be concrete in that situation, so essentially by saying undercutting Idaho Code 3205, and saying that any time you got a contingency and you don't have a solid number at that point until the contingency fee case has been resolved, and you have a number at that point.
All right, counsel, let me ask you about this. The total amount that you're seeking to recover is $361,000. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, could it be argued that part of that was indeed COIT? In other words, part of it had to do with prior services, but the remainder had to do with a percentage of the $450,000. Is that correct?
Correct to a point. The money from prior services was still involved with the same case, almost exclusively.
Yeah, but that was a determined amount of money. That there was no question as to that amount.
$137,000.
$137,000. That's what my notes indicate here.
And as of November 20th, 02, when fee agreement shifted and the contingency came in, because at this point they're so far behind on their bills, they can't pay their employees, they can't pay their taxes, and they can't pay their
attorneys. Well, was the argument ever made that at least as to the $137,000, that was COIT, and therefore you don't have the problem?
That argument is not made because the lien attached, according to the Idaho statute, relates back to the day that the first claim was filed, which was January 3rd, 02.
Yeah, but you've got a problem here where the government raises the inchoate issue. And I understand your argument against it,
yeah.
But
I think that's
as I look at your claim, the entire amount was a mix of something that had already been determined and something that was contingent.
That's correct. The problem with the not having a fixed sum is that undercuts the entire Idaho attorney lien statute. Then it's essentially asking this court to read that statute and say that it gives a first-in-time lien to those who represent clients on an hourly fee basis only. That certainly can't be the purpose of that statute.
But my understanding is, and it may be at least tentative understanding, you can correct me, is that while generally state law applies with regard to attorney's liens, the federal government will not recognize the timing of a lien as against a tax lien until it becomes co-ed, which is defined by a federal law legal standard. Is that not right?
But again, if the only reason for arguing that it wasn't co-ed was because...
And I'm asking, is that much right? Is it right that there is a essentially federal law incorporates state law up to a degree, but it doesn't incorporate state law as to the question of when the attorney's lien, fees lien becomes up, the timing of it as opposed to the timing of a tax lien. Is that right or wrong?
I agree that's what the IRS and I agree that's what the government would say.
Well, I understand what I said that, but is there a case law supporting it, aside from their argument? Is it true?
Not that I'm aware.
Is it correct?
I'm not in a position to disagree based on case law on that.
So your argument is that it's just not correct, that is not so, not as a matter of state law, but as a matter of federal law.
Correct, as applied to the state statute. Because I think you can't have one without the other.
So you believe that there isn't federal law that supports that proposition?
Excuse me?
So you say that there is no federal law supporting that proposition?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
And getting to the example three, this court wanted to be referred to, it's a perfect example of the misplaced reliance by the IRS on that statute itself. Getting back to the idea that you don't need a super priority, you don't need something that's going to jump you up ahead of the line if you're first in time. And the plain wording of that statute says that. And the purpose of that statute, referred to in the Capuano case out of the 11th Circuit, refers to that too, that both sides briefed. And so once it's determined that 6323 doesn't apply here, the issue becomes a set-off. And the district court properly recognized there's two situations where the government cannot set off a judgment. And one of those is where it would be inequitable, and the second one is where it's against public policy. And both of those reasons provide us two independent reasons not to allow the government to set this judgment off. It would be inequitable because, first of all, set-off's a doctrine of equity. The government has to come in with clean hands, and the facts show that's not the case. It was their termination. It was their wrongful withholding of periodic.
So back to example three, you're saying the difference is that the tax lien had already been filed at the time that the attorney's work began?
Example three?
Yes.
I think the very first line or the very first sentence of Example 3 shows why it's distinguishable from the case before us is there's notice of a lien in the amount of $8,000.
Meaning a tax lien. Is that what
that is? Tax lien. That's what they're referring to.
So the lien was first. That's what you're saying.
Exactly. And that's not the case here. Dun & Black refer back to January 3rd, 2002, when they filed their claim in the Federal Court of Claims. That's when Dun & Black lien was attached. There was no lien in place for almost 2 years. There's no notice of any tax liability. When Dun & Black started representation, they had no notice of any tax liability. A year and a half later, when they filed claim, there was no notice of any tax liability. To try and cite to an example where the attorney took the case with full knowledge that there's a tax liability, it's completely different from the case before this court. There was no notice on Dun & Black's part of any liability. And to follow the government's arguments, essentially asking attorneys to stay away from taking contingency fee cases of anybody with federal tax liability or might even have any federal tax liability. Because even if the state statute's going to provide you a priority, the government's going to jump over you every time. That's setting a standard and a signal to attorneys not to take these kind of cases, which gets back to the whole idea of defending this contingency fee system. Because that's not the precedent that we want to set. We want people to have representation, not just people who can pay hourly fees, people that don't have that ability, and they need to take cases on contingency. And the public policy argument, based on the set-off principle, which would be a second reading.
Can we back up for a minute? I had asked you about the source of any federal co-witness doctrine. You said there was no case law.
There's no case law, I was aware.
But there seem to be some Ninth Circuit cases that deal specifically with a federal co-witness doctrine, such as Bank of California, et cetera. Do you want to address those?
All of the cases in the government's briefing and all of the cases cited by us were not on point here because they didn't have the combination of a pre-existing attorney's lien prior to any tax lien coming in place and the government and their inequitable conduct. There's not a case out there we can look at for guidance here.
And what was the second reason?
Because the situation where the government itself caused the problem, it caused the tax deficiency. It can't look for equity to set off an amount that they caused. They caused ERA to seek legal counsel. It caused them to have to seek it on a contingency basis. And then they sat back for 3 years while Dun & Black rolled up their sleeves and got involved in this, got them almost $500,000, and then jumped back in and try and reap the entire reward.
You say at one point in the brief that presumably the judgment claims action could have been written to specifically have a fee amount, but it wasn't. And you say something about the government having written the judgment or something to that effect. Do you want to explain that any further?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
The Court of Claims judgment, which is where this money is coming from, the $450,000, right?
Correct.
Is inclusive of fees. You make some suggestion at one point that sort of came about because the government made it that way, but it didn't have to.
Maybe I'm too young to be this cynical, but I think there was more going on. I think that ERI had no ability to pay its tax deficiencies, and the IRS knew that. The Federal Highway Administration, they were involved in this litigation with ERI based on its wrongful termination, and they knew there was some exposure. And the IRS isn't going to pursue ERI because they can't pay. But maybe let the settlement go through, and then you jump in and you put them on notice. For 4 years, Dun & Black represented ERI with no contact with the IRS, the government, about tax liabilities. And coincidentally, 4 weeks after the settlement comes through, that's when you get notice of it. There's
four. If you want to reserve, you may do so.
Good. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court, I'm Curtis Pett, representing the United States. It's important to understand, Your Honors, that this case is not a matter of lien priorities. It's simply a matter of application of the set-off statute. Section 3728 is a condition on the government's waiver of sovereign immunity to suit. It provides that any judgment against the government shall be set off against any debt owed by the claimant to the government. The statute provides no exceptions. Dun & Black's request for this court to tack on an equitable exception runs afoul of the rule that waivers or exceptions to conditions on waivers of sovereign immunity are not to be implied.
Is the government conceding jurisdiction in this case?
No.
We don't get to set off principles, do we, unless there's something to talk about, unless the court...
There's no jurisdiction.
All right, but am I right? The argument you just made about set off wouldn't apply unless there were jurisdiction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I'm a little confused.
I do want to address Dun & Black's contentions that the government was engaging in misconduct in this case, which they raised in their reply brief, and we've not had a chance to respond to. But with respect to the jurisdictional issue, there is no basis for jurisdiction. Dun & Black's claim arises on its contingency fee contract with ERI, which is nothing more than an assignment by ERI of part of its claim against the government.
Okay, but what gets Dun & Black into federal district court to challenge or to assert its right to a portion of the $450,000? Is it 1346? Is it 2410? What is it that establishes jurisdiction here?
The case should be remanded to the district court for entry of an order dismissing Dun & Black's claim for lack of subject matter.
I understand your 2410 argument, but I don't understand your 1346 argument, A. B, you also make an exhaustion claim with regard to 1346 if it otherwise applies, and to my knowledge, that wasn't raised below. So I'd like you to address those two problems. How does 1346 apply, and why should we reach any exhaustion issue?
1346A1 does not apply. That statute allows for suits for refunds of income taxes erroneously or illegally assessed or collected. No taxes were collected from Dun & Black in this case, so that statute on its face.
But it doesn't say collected from X. It says erroneously collected. And the argument here, as I understand it, is that the set-off would be erroneous with regard to Dun & Black, even though Dun & Black isn't the taxpayer. So what's wrong with that? They're trying to collect the tax, essentially, by taking money that would otherwise go to Dun & Black through a set-off. Is that an accurate characterization?
Well, Dun & Black's contingency fee agreement only became effective if there was some sort of realization of the judgment, and they're basically
well, there is a judgment. There is a judgment, an actual judgment.
There's $450,000 in a pot, right?
Right.
Okay, and that's what we're talking about.
But that $450, because of the set-off statute, that $450,000 was set off against these other liabilities.
But that's the question.
That's
that can't
question.
Be the answer. In other words, the question is, are they entitled to the set-off? It can't be the answer to the jurisdictional question as well. Their contention is no. That's not the government's – government can't do that. It belongs to us. They're collecting money that actually is our money. Now, they may be wrong, but how could that determine the jurisdictional question?
It's our position that – they don't have standing under 1346A1 because a third party can't come into court and say, this friend of mine, you collected some taxes from him, and it wasn't right, and I want to complain about it.
But they're claiming – their substantive claim is we're not a third party. They're taking our money. They're collecting somebody else's taxes by taking it from us. They're taking our money to pay somebody else's taxes. That's their claim. We can get to the merits and decide that they're right or wrong about it, but that's their argument.
Well, the only relevant facts are that there's a judgment against the United States in favor of ERI, and that ERI owed taxes to the United States.
And that ERI also owed several hundred thousand dollars in attorney's fees to Dun & Broad.
All contingent upon whether or not there was any
Well, let's talk about contingent for just a moment. Did you hear my colloquy with counsel in terms of potentially some of the $361,000 being co-ed and some being inchoate?
Yes.
Okay. I gather that issue hasn't been raised. But assuming it had been raised, would the government's argument still be the same with respect to the co-ed portion of the $361,000?
Our position is that liens have nothing to do with this because of the operation of the set-off statute, there's nothing for their attorney's lien to attach to. Because of the set-off, there was no recovery on the judgment, and so the attorney's fees attach, the lien attaches.
Maybe we're talking about scintilla jura here, because you're assuming that the government's right to set-off somehow or other has priority over the contention they have that they have an attorney's lien with respect to the same sum. Now, that's the issue we're here to discuss. Who does have priority? Where does the Idaho statute fit with respect to this sum? And to the extent that we're talking about at least a portion being co-ed, why aren't they entitled to the co-ed portion?
Because it's a matter of timing. First, the set-off applies so that there is no recovery on the judgment. If there is no recovery on the judgment, their lien attaches to the recovery on the judgment. Their lien attaches to a zero sum.
You make a distinction between the judgment and the recovery on the judgment. Doesn't the lien attach to the judgment?
It does not attach to money in the United States Treasury, and that's what we're talking about. The money is sitting there in the United States Treasury, and Congress has stated that that money will not leave the United States Treasury to the extent that the claimant owes money to the United States Treasury.
Well, you're arguing sort of, as Judge O'Scanlan said, it's sort of the set-off is sort of like a super priority that can't be defeated, right? I mean, you always come first. What it amounts to?
Well, I think it's a problem to get into that because you've got lien issues and you've got set-off issues. It's a matter of timing. The judgment never leaves the United States Treasury because of Section 3728. Their lien attaches to whatever you want to call it, the judgment. There's no basis for saying that their lien would interfere with the operation of Section 3728. There's nothing in the statute. There's nothing in the case.
All right, let's assume for the sake of discussion only that there was no set-off. In other words, that was the $450,000 belongs to ERI. It was as a result of the resolution of the case against the government, not Treasury, but another agency. So you've got the pot of $450,000, and there is no tax assertion made with respect to that. How would this work? Wouldn't they have an Idaho law-based lien on the $450,000, which could be enforceable against the government, so the government would pay off the lien and then remit the remainder to ERI?
The lien is against the government?
Against the judgment. There's an attorney's lien. As a matter of fact, I don't see how this is much different than 301-6323-F1, Example 3.
Well, our position is that example is not relevant here because we're not. I mean, you're assuming that there was no set-off, but
it's what's called a hypothetical. I'm just trying to understand in my own mind how the sequencing works here. There's no question there's an Idaho-based lien. Isn't that true?
Right.
All right. How does that lien get enforced? And so for the sake of argument, let's assume there is no tax claim by the Treasury, but there is the $450,000 in the Treasury that should be remitted to ERI. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't the Treasury recognize the lien and pay it off directly to the law firm and then remit the remainder, or not?
No.
Why?
The whole purpose of the Anti-Assignment Act is that the government is not going to get involved in affairs like that. The judgment would be paid to ERI, and then Dun & Black would enforce their lien.
But that's not an assignment. It's an attorney's lien by virtue of state law, which, as I, my understanding is that that liens on are recognized in general. No? You're saying any lien is an assignment, so basically there's no lien that operates against the government. That's what you seem to be saying. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so, yes. Yeah, parties.
Then what's all this case law about liens and first in time and 6323 and so on? It's all spinach because there's no such thing as a lien against the government?
Well, there can be liens against a piece of property that the government, there can be a piece of property over there.
It's a piece of property in the amount of $450,000.
Pardon me?
The piece of property is a sum of $450,000. It happens to be sitting in the Treasury, but it's an identifiable piece of property.
There's a big difference if it's property out there on Main Street or property in the United States Treasury. No, it's well established that parties do not assert liens, or you cannot assert liens against United States government property. Your lien priority issues come about where a house on 231 Main Street, you've got a tax lien, you've got other liens, then you compare, but the government doesn't have the property, the government wants the property, the government has a lien against the property, and then you get into the battle of priorities, first in time, first in right, whatever the situation is, but it's completely different when you're talking about money in the United States Treasury.
So in your theory, the set-off doesn't matter, nothing matters, because all that matters in the end is you just can't have a lien against property that's being held by the government, period.
Well, our position is that Section 3728 states that if you have a judgment against the government, you shall set off that judgment against any debts owed by the claimant to the government. That's really the beginning and the end of it. These other issues are interesting, but they don't affect Section 3728.
All right. Now for the last quite a few minutes, we've been talking about the merits of the case, but I want to get back for a minute to the jurisdiction. Now, I understand your position is that the plaintiff cannot proceed under 1346 because they did not pay the tax, right? That's your basic position now. But assuming, the argument is correct, and I don't know whether it is or not, but assuming the argument is correct that, they're entitled to proceed under 1346 because their position is that this tax was illegally collected because the money should have gone first to them, right? To say that, that's the basis for proceeding under 1346. I think your fallback argument is even assuming they can otherwise proceed under 1346, they're still barred because they did not exhaust their administrative remedies. Are you making that argument?
Yes, absolutely.
What do you mean by that? They had to file a claim with IRS? Is that what you mean?
Right. Yeah, exhaust administrative remedies, file an administrative claim for refund with the IRS.
So that's a different bar than your basic argument about.
Yeah, there are two separate independent bars. First, no tax was collected from them, so they don't have standing.
Am I correct that wasn't raised in the district court?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why isn't that the end of that?
It doesn't matter because it's jurisdictional, huh?
Yes, jurisdiction must be raised at any stage.
Well, it's jurisdictional in an 11th Amendment sense, right? Not 11th Amendment, in a sovereign immunity sense. It's jurisdictional only because anything that runs against the government is jurisdictional. Otherwise, it wouldn't be jurisdictional. It would just be procedural.
It's a condition on the waiver of sovereign immunity for refunds.
Okay, but that doesn't mean that exhaustion requirements aren't waivable by the United States because sovereign immunity is waivable.
I don't believe sovereign immunity is waivable.
Of course it's waivable. What do you mean it's not waivable? We have lots of case law saying it's waivable.
I'm not aware of it. My understanding is that if the parties don't raise jurisdiction, then the court is obligated.
Jurisdiction, yes, when it's jurisdiction in the sense of the capacity of the court to proceed. But when it's jurisdictional in the sense of sovereign immunity, it's waivable.
Congress can waive sovereign immunity. I'm not authorized. Nobody else is authorized.
But let's get even more limited, though. Even assuming this is part of the sovereign immunity argument, if you don't raise ever the issue about exhaustion, then that argument is waived, right? The exhaustion argument. So in that sense, it's waivable, isn't it? Exhaustion is part of your sovereign immunity claim, but if you don't raise exhaustion...
I think my understanding is that even if the parties don't raise jurisdiction, that it's up to the court to make sure that...
That's true.
Suppose you said in your brief, drop a footnote saying, Dun & Black, we note that they didn't file an administrative claim, but, we're waiving that.
Yeah, well, the merits are so interesting, we'll go ahead and take jurisdiction just for the fun of it.
Is that a proper waiver?
I wouldn't have authority. I could try it, but I don't think I would have legal authority to do that.
Well, let's assume that we're talking about the second argument, that is, that there's 1346 jurisdiction but no exhaustion. Is the government comfortable with that argument as an alternate argument?
That there is jurisdiction but no exhaustion.
In other words, no exhaustion under 7422, which, of course, was not raised in the trial court, but how about it?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Are we willing to concede jurisdiction under 1346A1 as a matter of standing?
No, with respect to the you said there were two reasons why 1346 doesn't work. We understand your standing argument.
Okay.
The other argument is that there was no exhaustion.
Right.
All right. To the extent there was no exhaustion, the government is conceding that at least there's a threshold basis for jurisdiction?
No, these are alternate arguments. Either one could stand alone as jurisdictional bars.
Your argument is that even if the court should conclude that they can make a claim, otherwise make a claim in the 1346, they would still be barred by failure to exhaust.
Correct.
It's sort of an alternate argument.
Correct.
But that argument wasn't made in the trial court.
That's correct.
So it's conceivable we could find that there was waiver with respect to 7422, at least arguably. That's all we're doing right now.
If it's a waivable matter.
I can tell you my position. I can't tell you what you could. You're the boss.
Your position is certainly wrong with respect to the notion that sovereign immunity in general isn't waivable in a courtroom. I mean, we have many cases in which that happens. We probably have cases in which exhaustion has been waived. In fact, I know we do. So how can that be? I mean, suppose you had made a choice to stand up here and say in the district court, well, it's true that 7422 requires exhaustion, but let's not worry about that. Our only argument is based on 1346 not applying. You couldn't have done that, and the court wouldn't have been bound by it, and you could have stood up here 2 years later and argued otherwise?
That's my understanding, yes. That's our view, yes. If I could I refute to explain that there was no government misconduct in this case? We haven't had a chance. They raised certain allegations in their reply brief.
You may do so, sir.
There, in the Court of Federal Claims action that gave rise to the judgment, that case was settled. The stipulation of settlement expressly provides that there was no admission of liability. They're relying solely on ERI's allegations that were unproven in that litigation to prove that there's government misconduct at the level of what gave rise to the settlement. And as far as the taxes, these were employment taxes, that the liability arose when ERI paid the taxes, when they paid wages to their employees, their employment taxes, they withheld federal income taxes.
They didn't remit.
They failed to remit. The employees were given credit for having paid their taxes, and to the extent that they decided not to file their duty under the law to hold on to those taxes and remit them, they're the culpable party, and the government is not culpable. And Dun & Black's contention that they were improperly denied notice of these taxes is somewhat disingenuous because they were intimately involved with ERI's affairs prior to the year 2000. One of their attorneys, Richard Campbell, stated that he was on their board of directors. These tax liabilities arose back in periods from 1999 to 2003. The fact that they were this longstanding involvement with the corporation, that they knew they were in financial difficulties, that they wanted to get involved in a contingent fee agreement.
When did the government first assert its employment tax claim? Against ERI?
The first notice, it was back in that early period. I could look and see.
But it predated the $450,000 settlement?
Yes. Yes, these were on. These periods overlap
okay. To
a large degree. But the fact of the matter is that Dun & Black was involved with this corporation and knew they were in financial difficulties. And at the very least, they should have inquired of ERI as to whether he was current on his taxes before entering in this type of agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Tucker, you have some reserved time.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, as far as the jurisdiction issue goes, certainly Dun & Black's position is that because 7422 wasn't addressed at the trial court level, if that's something that can be waived, it has been. But to address it, I think there's some confusion because 7422 establishes a condition precedent in an action to recover taxes that the taxpayer files, when the taxpayer files the action. And that's in our brief. And that's straight out of a case from the circuit in 84. And the district court properly found that under 1346, there was proper jurisdiction.
But your problem is the language of 7422 and the language of 1346 are pretty similar. So if 7422 only applies to taxpayers, then you're sort of backing yourself into the argument that 1346 doesn't apply to you either. It seems to me that they seem to be fairly parallel, and it doesn't the notion that there's a category of people who can sue under 1346 but don't have to exhaust under 7422 is somewhat problematical. That's what your argument is, right? There's a category of people who can bring suit and not exhaust.
Certainly, Your Honor. Under 1346, the district court properly cites the language with the broad language uses the word any, five times, any civil action against the United States, any sum alleged.
7422 have basically the same broad language?
This circuit has held that 7422, not referring to 1346 in Boyd v. U.S., it applies to the taxpayer who filed the claim. Here, the district court found that there's people other than a taxpayer who can have jurisdiction to fight this and that maybe don't have to satisfy this condition precedent, which is for the taxpayer. That's the position Dun & Black has on the jurisdiction issue. As far as the liability, I just wanted to touch on that. The government terminated ERI for default. As the court knows, that's a breach of contract. Dun & Black got involved in the settlement that was changed to a termination for convenience, which allowed it to have reasonable costs and a reasonable profit. So it can be termed anything they want to call it, but the termination for default was certainly improper. There's $450,000 sitting in the U.S. Treasury. If this court recognizes that Dun & Black had a valid Kohate attorney lien, there's still going to be a windfall for the government. There's still going to be almost $90,000 sitting there that wouldn't be there but for Dun & Black's efforts. If this court is
assuming that the government is correct, that there were employment taxes withheld but never remitted to the government certainly has a proper claim with respect to those, does it not?
I don't think there's an issue about the government, that there was tax liabilities. The issue is that there was no notice and that Dun & Black got involved here, created this common fund, and but for their efforts, there'd be no fund at all. By recognizing Dun & Black's valid lien...
Well, do you want to respond to Mr. Pitt's, let's say, innuendo that you, being the law firm representing this company all along, had to have known that there were unpaid employment taxes withheld and not remitted?
The very first tax lien was filed on August 29, 2003. We had our sleeves rolled up, and Dun & Black was into this for 2 years at that point. 2 years and 7 months. The very first time there was lien. There wasn't a tax judgment until November 29, 2004. 5 months after the common fund created by Dun & Black was in place. I know I heard the innuendo, and I think the facts show otherwise. I think the facts show maybe what I was referring to, that there might have been more going on here. If the court is inclined to distinguish the $137,000 that may have been Kohate prior to the transfer of the fee agreement to contingency, I would ask this court to remand that to the district court to address that issue specifically, as neither side has briefed that specific issue. But as to the $450,000 sitting in the U.S. Treasury today, all Dun & Black is asking is to enforce its valid attorney lien, have it be compensated for the work it put in, and leave the excess to the government. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
The case just argued will be submitted for decision.